This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:05. It's Thursday, August 23rd, 2018. Welcome and thank you for joining us on the Noon Business Hour today. I'm Rob Hart.
And I'm Chris Kreidel. A very nice day, mostly sunny, a high temperature of 80, increasing clouds later on, maybe a thunderstorm tomorrow. It's 76 degrees right now at O'Hare.
Well, the markets were struggling to pick a lane during the morning hours. What will the afternoon have in store for us? Let's go to Bloomberg now and Elisa Parenti.
Well, Rob, right now we've got all three of the averages in the red, but not too big a set of losses here. The Dow is down about a third of a percent, or 81 points. The NASDAQ going between small losses. It just now went to a small gain, up a fraction of a point. The S&P off 4 points. The Bloomberg WBBM Chicago Index down a third of a percent. The mixed performance can be traced to trade tensions and trade talks. The U.S. and China added new tariffs on billions of dollars of goods overnight. And at the same time, talks are underway with China, as well as talks with Mexico on trying to secure NAFTA. There have been few signs the trade fight was hurting U.S. hiring, and it's not bringing about layoffs on a large scale either. Applications for jobless benefits fell again last week to a total 210,000, close to a five-decade low. The numbers have added importance because this was the week the Labor Department conducted its surveys of households and businesses for the big August jobs report. Oil slightly lower at the moment, but still up almost 4% for the week at $67.71 a barrel. Back to you, Rob and Chris.
Thanks, Elisa. On today's Noon Business Hour, we're going to be talking about the issue the markets are worrying about, U.S.-China trade. And the president warns that the markets would crash if he were removed from office.
And then it's Technology Thursday. We will talk about the world of genetically modified mosquitoes and how they can be used to stop the spread of disease.
It's 60 Minutes of Financial Planning. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Starbucks has a plan to pay employees for time spent helping nonprofit organizations in their community. We will cover that in our next segment. Right now, the president's talking about the potential economic impact should lawmakers impeach him. While the report on sales of new homes is leading today's data, we are joined by Bob Bruska, chief economist at Fact and Opinion Economics in New York. Bob, thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour.
My pleasure.
The president goes on to say that everybody would be poor because the markets would crash if he were run out of office. What do you think of this kind of talk?
Well, this sounds like the typical flamboyant Donald Trump. I don't know why he would be trying to talk about being run out of office at this point. It seems to me that there's some unclear and somewhat marginal evidence that's been presented that might put him in a bad light. I'm not sure that there's anything that would turn him out of office. But Donald Trump is nothing if not sensitive about any criticism that he gets.
The world is watching, of course. What do you think they're thinking?
Well, I don't think they know quite what to make of it. I mean, you know, just watching it myself, it certainly has been a spectacle. We know that that Bill Clinton had sexual liaisons while in office, and they led to his impeachment, although the impeachment was not successful. The trial for impeachment was brought. These are things that occurred before the campaign, and the question really is about campaign financing. And, you know, there are all kinds of politicians who have little technical problems with campaign financing, and I don't see anything here that would seem to me to rise to the gravity of impeachment or, you know, a serious criminal charge. You know, campaign finance laws are complicated. There are all kinds of rules. Almost every politician runs afoul of them here or there. And so I'm a little bit surprised that this has taken on such a life of its own, although clearly Mr. Trump has a lot of enemies or a lot of people that would, you know, do anything, use any pretext for getting him out of office, sort of like, you know, arresting Al Capone for jaywalking.
Well, let's go back to the late 1998, early 1999, when President Clinton was impeached by the House and then acquitted by the Senate. Despite all of the palace intrigue in Washington and the fact that the Star report was read by seemingly everybody, that did not slow down the late 90s economic expansion by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, no. I mean, politics is not economics. And of course, Mr. Trump is saying if he's thrown out of office, that would have an impact, and that very possibly would. He's been quite an advocate of growth, and while there are a lot of things about Mr. Trump I find pretty uncomfortable, I think a lot of his economic policies have been very helpful. I think that he reversed, a slippage into just stifling regulation that had been going on under the Obama administration that has been helpful for the economy. But as always, the pendulum swings. We go to too much regulation, and we swing back to something that makes sense, and then we swing back too far to something that goes too far the other way, and then the pendulum swings back. It's one of the reasons why, when Romney was running for office, he came up with this figure of 47%. 47% of the people who file federal tax returns pay no federal income tax. And, we spend our time doing what the Republicans want and undoing it, doing what the Democrats want and undoing it, doing what Republicans want and undoing it. And, as we go back and forth, we wind up chewing up a lot of money and chewing up a lot of time and not making any progress. And, our political system uses Republicans and Democrats. They've run the country, since there have been Republicans and Democrats. And now what they have done is these two parties together have ruined, poisoned the environment for doing business. And we're finally unwinding some of that. And I would beg both of these parties to come to their senses and to do something that's good for the country. I really don't care about the Republicans or the Democrats. Frankly, I'm an independent. I don't care for either one of them. I don't care for their politics. I don't care for what they do. And I don't care for what either party stands for, because they mostly stand for themselves. I would like to see a party that stood for the American people and for getting growth on track and for trying to preserve the values that that we know as Americans. And I'm tired of this pettiness.
Well,
very tired of saying we need a president that's a certain sex or a certain color. We need a president that has a certain set of skills. That's what we need.
Well, very briefly, let's step away from politics and take a look at new home sales falling to a 9-month low in July. Anything to be read out of that?
The housing sector is slowing down. Interest rates are going up. And I've been talking to friends of mine that are realtors, and they're telling me that the millennials are extremely sensitive to any increase in mortgage rates. And even though the increase hasn't been that great, you're getting some pushback on it, and there's concerns about how far this is going to go. Housing prices, of course, are already high. They've risen much faster than incomes, and this depletes affordability. And now with mortgage rates pushing up and the Fed chomping at the bit to raise them even more, people are looking for mortgage rates to continue to run up, and this is causing concern about housing. Although we've had good job growth, we haven't had good job growth and the kind of higher income jobs that you need to buy houses at the current prices that they are. So maybe what we need are not two-headed of household families, but three- or four-headed household families so they can afford a house.
We'll keep an eye on that. Bob, thanks for joining us today. Bob Ruska is the chief economist at Fact and Opinion Economics in New York. Up next, Starbucks employees will get a chance to perform community service and get paid for it.
Your best stock option. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Starbucks is testing a program that would pay employees to do work at a local nonprofit. Let's talk about business and philanthropy with Jessica Schaefer, who is the senior director at the LaSalle Network based in Chicago. Jessica, welcome to the program. Let's
Thank
talk
you,
about the benefit for Starbucks here, because there were two kind of schools of thought surrounding this proposal. The first one is, if you're a shareholder, how does this create value for you? And the second one is, how does this create value for the company? So let's tackle the first one. If you're a Starbucks shareholder and you're hearing about this program for the first time, how should you react to it?
Sure. So I think there's two schools of thought even in this arena, and I think one could be this is a straight marketing play, and they're trying to get a little positive publicity after some negative racial discrimination publicity a few weeks ago. Or the other school of thought is that it actually can be better for the brand because it's creating a positive perception of Starbucks, and they're giving back to their people and reinvesting in their communities, and so more people, more customers are going to go to Starbucks to buy their products as a result.
Is this also, could it also be viewed as a reaction to the tight labor market, that this is just another way that that Starbucks could recruit when there are so many other options out there?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I mean, unemployment's at its lowest that it's almost ever been, 3.9%, and competition for hourly workers especially is tough, and this program targets hourly workers, so 36 employees from Starbucks are going to be volunteering for 6 months for 20 hours a week. Absolutely, it's a ploy to help them get and attract more hourly workers and also retain the folks that they have.
Supporting refugees and veterans and military families is one goal. What are they offering, or where are they going to be going?
So I believe it's that they work within their local communities to identify charities that are already tied to Starbucks' main philanthropy goals, and then work within those to allocate money and allocate resources.
And how does this kind of square up with other corporate philanthropic and volunteer efforts? Is this fairly ambitious, or does this line up with a lot of, you know, what other Fortune 500 companies are doing?
Yeah, I think Starbucks always does it a little bit better because they're ahead of the curve on the marketing game. And they talk about their initiatives really, really well. There's a lot of Fortune 500 companies that do a ton of philanthropy work and maybe just don't market it quite as well. You know, Salesforce is one of those companies that comes to mind. All of their new hires volunteer on their very first day, and then they committed to give 1% of their profits, 1% of their equity, and 1% of employees' time to give back to philanthropic causes. But not a lot of people know about that. So I think Starbucks really has that finesse of good marketing coupled with really good ideas.
And as you mentioned, that they had some making up to do with the community because of the problems with the expelling a couple of people who were there at one point. Are we going to expect to see a lot of a print or broadcast campaign, you know, where they will be telling you what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I would think that their marketing department probably has it all mapped out. To really get the biggest bang for their buck with this 36 employees, they're going to need to do a ton of internal messaging, a ton of pictures, a ton of video blogs, and I think we'll see that publicly too.
And will we see some competitors rising up and doing much the same thing?
I think so. I think even if they're just publicizing what they currently do a little bit better, they're going to step up their game because they need to attract the folks that Starbucks are trying to attract.
And you mentioned Salesforce as one example of corporate philanthropy. Any other examples of either corporate philanthropy that's unique or goes above and beyond typical corporate volunteer efforts?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. You're putting me on the spot, Rob. Off the top of my head, I can speak to what we do at LaSalle really well, but I don't know of other big Fortune 500 companies. I don't know specifically what their corporate social responsibility programs look like. I know for us at LaSalle, it's helped us in attracting more people. We're not by any means at the Starbucks level, but because we started marketing our philanthropic efforts even more, we have candidates that are coming in and saying, I want to work at LaSalle because of the philanthropy work that you're doing. And we've seen an increase in applicants as a result.
Well, thank you very much for the insights this afternoon, Jessica Schaefer, Senior Director at the LaSalle Network based in Chicago. Still ahead in Technology Thursday, using genetics to prevent mosquitoes from transmitting disease.
WBBM News Time, 12:25. Let's take a look at the markets now, sponsored by Elmhurst BMW. Here's Elisa Peretti.
Chris, we remain split here with the Dow down 89 points, or a third of a percent, while the NASDAQ up just 2 and the S&P off 4. The Wintrust WBBM Chicago Index from Bloomberg is sliding a third of a percent. Crude oil futures are up almost 4% this week, slightly lower on the day to $67.76 a barrel. Now let's check in with Pete Manhart at Bates Commodities in Normal. Pete?
Grain prices ahead of harvest lower today. Good expectation of good harvest yields. December corn, 362.5, down 4.25. We have November soybeans down 8.25 at 862, and December wheat down 4 at 541.25. All lower across the board. And this is Pete Manhart at Bates Commodities and Normal.
Thank you, Pete. With business at 25 and 55, live from the Bloomberg Newsroom, Elisa Parenti, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
WBBM News Time, 12:30. Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart.
I'm Chris Kreidel. These are the top stories on News Radio, WBBM.
Stocks are mixed. We'll see what's weighing on Wall Street and later talk about the possibility of a bear market.
Technology Thursday, genetically engineered mosquitoes could be a great weapon against the transmission of dangerous and even deadly diseases.
The Yorkville Police Department fires a sergeant after video captures the taunting of a suspect.
Torrential downpours from Hurricane Lane are soaking Hawaii's Big Island right now as the storm moves closer.
WBBM Business, the Dow is down 76 points, the S&P 500 down 3.25, the NASDAQ is up 4.
Sunny skies heading for a high today of 80. It's 76 at O'Hare, 77 at the lakefront.
And the Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. WBBM News Time, 12:31. Markets are heading lower at this hour. We're joined by Jack Ablin, the Chief Investment Officer at Crescent Wealth Advisors based in Chicago. Jack, let's start off with, I guess, what would be the headline story of the day, and that is President Trump saying during his interview with Fox and Friends this morning that if he were to be impeached, the market would crash, and in his words, quote, everybody would be poor. Is this a Trumpian bluster, or does history back up the fact that during times of political uncertainty that the U.S. Stock markets would actually experience some turmoil?
Well, I would say mostly bluster, Rob, although keep in mind early in President Trump's tenure, if you recall, there were some issues related to whether or not he was going to keep his job, and there was some uncertainty there, and the market was pretty upset about it. Investors really were caught somewhat off balance. I think since that time, however, we've certainly experienced a whole new domestic policy, including pretty wide sweeping corporate tax reform. And so for the most part, anything that perhaps President Trump would have held back or held in the bag waiting to introduce has already been out there. And so this time around, I think that while investors certainly could be caught off balance, by an impeachment, I don't think we'd see a market crash as a result.
Well, also to provide some perspective, too, if there were to be impeachment proceedings, it would require the clearance of a great many hurdles. First off, the House of Representatives would have to change from a Republican majority to a Democratic majority, and that even that is yet to be determined. That's in November.
I'm going to say right now that better than a coin flip chance of that happening at the moment.
Yes, that does look likely. And then there would have to be investigations, and then there would have to be charges in the House. Then it goes to the Senate, and removal from office is a very high hurdle to clear there.
Yeah, and this is the real issue, Rob. It turns out if you really look at it, the Republicans have 48 pretty solid seats. The Democrats have, I think it was 44 or 45, something like that, and there are probably 7 or 8 seats, quote-unquote, up for grabs. The Democrats would have to take 7 of those 8 seats in order to command a majority in the Senate. That just seems rather unlikely. It's possible, but it's pretty unlikely.
Let's move over to the markets. Actually, a record bull market now this week. And the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index is up 324% over almost 9.5 years. What now, Jack?
Yeah, I mean, generally, but bull markets don't die of old age. They generally die of excesses and recessions. And one of the things underpinning this market recovery is a very shallow, very steady economic recovery. One of the things is, you know, we've been wringing our hands for the last couple of years saying, boy, you know, we're only getting on average 2% growth. Obviously, last quarter was an exception to that. But the interesting thing about it is our potential growth rate, the capacity of our economy, is only about 2 to 2.5%. And so to be able to grow right at that capacity rate, without having to spur, you know, excess demand and then run out of supplies of either labor or inventories or capacity, allows us to just continue to plod along at a nice steady pace. So I don't right now see any threat of recession, unless, of course, we start to get some inflation, and that the Fed has to then go raise rates and try to track down.
All right. Thanks for joining us today. Jack Ablin is Chief Investment Officer at Crescent Wealth Advisors here in Chicago. Up next, Technology Thursday, using genetics to stop mosquitoes from spreading disease.
An economy of words. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Technology Thursday, and we're examining how science and tech are helping prevent the spread of disease. We welcome Professor Ethan Beer. He is a professor of biology at University of California in San Diego. So let's start with the problem, mosquitoes. Some of the most deadly creatures on the planet carry viruses, bacteria, parasites, and they will transmit through bites, infecting some 700 million people, killing more than 1 million each year. That really stopped me today, Professor Beer. Tell us what you're doing about it.
Well, Chris, one of the things that we're doing is we're in collaboration with a longstanding mosquito biologist at University of California, Irvine, Anthony James. We are trying to design mosquitoes that carry immunizing factors that would bind to the parasite and prevent the mosquito from then transmitting the disease malaria, which is caused by the malarial parasite. And so there's been quite a bit of success that he has had over the years in developing these immunizing factors that get induced upon female mosquitoes, which are the only ones that actually bite you, having a blood meal. And that therefore, these molecules that are foreign to the mosquito are only produced in this very limited sense, the time when the female is biting, and then bind to the parasite, preventing its transmission. And we've devised a genetic system that allows those mosquitoes to transmit that genetic information to all of their progeny, or nearly all of their progeny. And so if you release a few of those mosquitoes into the wild in principle, you should be able to disseminate those anti-malarial antibodies or immunizing agents throughout the population, and therefore render that mosquito population refractory to transmission of malaria.
Are we still mostly inside doing testing, or is out
it's
on the market?
At the experimental stage inside. Nothing has been released outside.
And how long would it take to, will it take to continue testing? And then once you've tested and developed a mosquito that can do all of the things that you want it to do, how do you introduce it to nature, or do you introduce it to nature?
Well, those are quite a few questions stacked there, but the lab part is pretty straightforward. There are two components to it. One, of course, one has to develop a mosquito that really does transmit the genetic information to all of its progeny, and we're close to that. I would say we're within 2 years of being able to get a mosquito that has the ability to do that. Then there's the other side of it, which is we have to make sure that the antibodies that are being produced by the mosquitoes, the agents that are binding and inactivating the parasite, really do it in a very complete way and do it even to overcome the expected evolution of the parasite to avert that activity. And so it's kind of like a cancer therapy principle where you have several of these different antibodies produced at the same time that interfere with different stages of the parasite maturation. And so it's very difficult for the parasite then to evolve against all of those at the same time. And hence the hope is that at some point then, if you were allowed to release that in the field, you'd really be able to take out the parasites from the population before they could evolve around the intervention. But then the bigger question of how do you get that to the field, and you know, is one that involves a lot of social engagement, because people have to agree that this is a technology they want to see tested. And so the first thing to do would be to test it in big cages outdoors, where at least the air goes through the cages in a natural way, and then perhaps release them on an island somewhere where there either are no people or very few people, and then see that the genetic elements are distributed as we would expect to all the progeny. And then once those tests are done, which maybe could be on the time scale of, say, 5 years if everything went smoothly, then, of course, it becomes an issue of social and regulatory consideration as to whether they should actually be used, which I imagine would depend on how well they prove themselves in those initial tests.
And lastly, you know, we have about a minute left here. I mean, what are there's been some talk about genetically modified food. You're working with genetically modified mosquitoes. Genetic modification and introducing that into the world in the 21st century. What are some of the applications we might see going forward as this becomes more prevalent?
Well, you know, I think it's a question of how the perceptions of genetically modified organisms may change during the next decade or so. My hope is that it changes in a favorable way and people recognize that one can use these targeted manipulations of organisms to make very precise changes that only accomplish the goals that are desired. In contrast to, you know, prior breeding that was done, say, with, you know, X-ray mutagenesis of tomatoes, so you get a big fat tomato, but in addition to having a big fat tomato, you have all these mutations scattered throughout its genome, which is how it was done back in the 50s and 60s. And so I think what we have now is essentially precision designing of organisms, and if people can understand that that's not something to be afraid of, and it's done responsibly and transparently, then hopefully the perception of genetically modified organisms will improve to the point where people see it as the positive that it can be.
Well, thank you for all the important and interesting information today. Professor Ethan Beer is a professor of biology, University of California in San Diego. Join us at this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. Still to come, could a bear market be in our future?
The best daily deal in Chicago, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The record run on Wall Street has some investors bracing themselves for a correction or even a bear market. Let's get the perspective of Mark Hulbert, who is the investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington. Mark, welcome back to the program. At first, it was waiting for Godot, and then it was waiting for the interest rate hike, and now it's waiting for the stock market correction. And even though there's been some turmoil this year, the big-time regression has yet to occur. What do you think? What does the future hold for us in the near term?
I wish we could know. I always am reminded when in the series of things you mentioned there in your intro of what uncertainty gets resolved, and we find that no matter what uncertainty gets resolved, somehow there's something else just coming around the pike to make it seem like the uncertainty is always there. And I think it's forever thus. The markets will always have to be responding to uncertainty because, of course, I'm saying something that's obvious, but the future is always going to be uncertain. So I find that a lot of people act as though, well, as soon as the Fed releases its minutes, or as soon as this happens, or as soon as that happens, then we'll be able to decide what to do with our money. And I tell them they're never going to ever feel that degree of confidence because they just have to deal with an uncertain future.
This is a record bull market. Would you suggest that investors kind of sit on the side and watch it for a while before moving?
Well, you know, there are a couple things I want to say in response to that. One is I am actually not in the camp of those who think that we have reached a record length of a bull market. In fact, if you use a very rigorous definition of what a bear market involves, there were probably one, if not two, bear markets since 2009. So a lot of people who are now saying, well, we're into close to a 10-year bull market because it began in 2009 are overlooking history there. So that's point number one. But secondly, bull markets don't die of old age. It turns out that unlike animals, human beings, and so forth, who do die of old age, bull markets do not. They'll die of something else that causes it. And so I think this focus on what a lot of investors are focusing now is misplaced. They think that, well, now it's been so long we need to sit on the sidelines because a bear market is now more likely. Bear markets happen, but they happen just as often after 2 years of a bull market as with a 10-year bull market. So I think, yes, that's part of the uncertainty I mentioned, but unfortunately we're not going to be able to say much more than that.
All right. We'll keep in touch. Mark, thanks for joining us today. Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for The Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com in Washington. If you missed any part of today's Noon Business Hour, we'll have the replay podcast available shortly at WBBMNewsRadio.com and the all-new Radio.com app.
WBBM News Time, 12:55, WBBM Business from Bloomberg, and here's Elisa Parenti.
Rob, we continue to be mixed here with the Dow lower by a third of a percent or 86 points, while the NASDAQ pushing higher by just 2 points. We're at 78.91, and the S&P lower by 4 points. The Wintrust WBBM Chicago Index from Bloomberg sliding a third of a percent. Trade tensions are weighing on stocks as another round of U.S. tariffs goes into effect, along with Chinese retaliatory tariffs on American goods. Big companies that do a lot of business outside the U.S. are feeling the impact. Caterpillar is the biggest decliner on the Dow, and Boeing is contributing the most to the index's loss. Its shares down about 1%. Pink looks more like red on L Brand's earnings report. The lingerie and loungewear brand is slipping. Analysts are wondering about the company's decision to bring a non-apparel executive to take the place of its departing chief. L Brand's Victoria's Secret has been struggling with falling shares, with falling sales, and so shares are falling. Now L Brand's is sinking more than 10%, a correction on the day. With business at 25 and 55, live from the Bloomberg Newsroom, Elisa Parenti, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
WBBM and HD Chicago, WCFS FM and HD1 Elmwood Park, Chicago.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.